clearly my mum is in the house. Thank you. Hi, mum. One thing I always like to say is that you're not at home on your sofas watching Netflix or watching the tennis or the football. You've come out and you're with other people. You're not here by yourself. You may have arrived by yourself, but you're no longer alone. And what I'd like you all to do is to turn to your left and right, say your name to your neighbor, and say the words, "Peace be with you."
I said your name, Malaika.
Malaika.
I can't believe I said your name.
Okay.
Grew up in the Catholic Church.
Yeah. It's a bit Sunday morning.
When I was at medical school, many years ago, hello Victoria, with Victoria actually, when you were dissecting in the dissection room, they called the sound that you just made the chant of pleasant exploration. So thanks for reminding me about that. So we're going to discuss really this theme of "We Were There," which is the theme and idea put forward by Lanry Bakary, who's written this wonderful book, "We Were There." And that's the reason why... that's really the reason why we're here. No, we're not here because of Lanry Bakary, because my mother and my father produced me. anyway, I don't know why I said that. But anyway, so I'm really delighted to... I'm going to relax now. I was a bit tense, but I'm relaxing. I'm reclining. I'm gone horizontal. I was so delighted about a year or so ago to be summoned to listen to this amazing musician after my partner alerted me to the fact that he'd been on an Adam Buxton show. Adam Buxton heartily recommended all of Brighton to go down and listen to Dowdy Matsidko. So Dowdy Matsidko's here after a year of chasing him. And his first album as the King of Misery. And they're sad songs, but they're not miserable songs, I think. But I also have to alert you to the fact that it's Dowdy's birthday today. Fine voices you have. What a lovely voice. Thank you. And did you love that?
I love that.
You love that.
Thank you
so much. next to Dowdy, we have, I know everybody here very well now, we have Malaika Booker, who I've known for a number of years. And Malaika famously has written this wonderful collection a while ago called The Pepper Seed, which is one of my favourite collections of poetry. And Malaika, a few days ago, was made a Doctor of Philosophy. In Newcastle, so hats off to Malaika. Malaika will read a few poems in the course of this hour or so. And we have Lanry Bakary, who you know, who's written this wonderful book. It's his first book. And I suppose we ought to appreciate the fact that he's from Bradford.
That was at least Bradford noise ever, whoever did.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's not your only book, because we're going to encourage Lanry to write another book to include other places. We'll talk about that a bit later. And beside Lanry, we have Thee Freeman, who's a documentary filmmaker, and we're going to be showing an extract of one of her films, They Haven't Done Nothing, which was made in 1985, wasn't it, Thee? So yes. Thee Freeman. So I should explain that we're only here because we are Writers Mosaic. Writers Mosaic is a platform, a website, a resource tool for writers of the global majority. If we had a strapline above the door, we'd say writers for the global majority, but all are welcome. All are welcome. So we're not a colourist organisation at all, really. In a funny way, we're kind of an interracial organisation in many regards. That's true. I'm glad I got a laugh because I was hoping for a few laughs in the course of the evening. I should also say that I'm a Lutonian. Wow, interesting. How many people here have been to Luton? And before you answer, how many people have been to Luton, not just the airport and not the football ground? Ah, one Lutonian in the house. Good, good, good. Well, Luton's a great place. I was born there. And actually, when I was thinking about Luton, when I was growing up, I grew up in a place called Farley Hill, and it was at the top of Luton, and there was a hill called Longcroft Hill. And I would go to Longcroft Hill and look over Luton late at night and see all the stars and the lights on the buildings. And I thought, oh, Los Angeles. And there was this amazing path from the Parrot Pub, a pub called the Parrot, down to Stockwood Park, and the road was called Whipley Way. And when it's a really lovely tree-lined road, and to my mind, it was like the Champs-Élysées. It was so beautiful. Oftentimes, you think, actually, the centre of your universe is where you are. Forget London. Luton is the centre of Britain. So anyway, there you go. So, Lena, we're going to kick off with you, and we're going to ask everyone, actually, about why they're here. But, we were there. Can you explain the title, for starters?
Yes. It is about black presence in Britain and about hidden histories and this idea that if you look back at the period I'm writing about, which is the late 70s going into the 80s, often black histories aren't presented in that period, or the ones that are very limited. So I want to explore that and expand that canon, basically, and bring in all kinds of different stories from all around the country. Sadly, not Luton.
We'll get to Luton in a little while. So, Malaika, when you heard about this book being written, what was your first reaction?
I just love the idea of documenting, of archiving, and of having real live people as the testimonials in terms of the fact that our history is presented orally. So I was just very impressed and couldn't wait to kind of read it.
Yeah, I was really enthralled. I was really kicking myself for not having written it. It's such a great idea, really. Such a great idea. So a while ago, before the book was written, you got a call from a young man called Lanry Bacaray, who said, I want to interview you for the book. And what was your response?
My first response was, oh, no, not somebody else, because I didn't know this guy. And I didn't know what he was writing about. And I get called upon so many times because, not just as a filmmaker, but of my archive and stuff I've done over the years. So I needed this young man to explain himself, why he's writing.
And how did he do?
First of all, about the black communities.
In Liverpool.
In Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And then he talked to me and he'd spoken to certain people and why he was doing it. And I questioned him quite a lot.
Yeah,
didn't you?
I think you told me to write like a different book. I remember you saying, like, actually, it's more interesting if you look at like the kind of interwar period and all these performers.
Yes, I wanted him to write another book.
So I've signed a contract now. I kind of need to do it. Can you help me?
So that's why. And I felt, well, here we have a young man who's writing something differently. And you know, sometimes, you know, you with your knowledge, you think, well, it's not my knowledge. My knowledge needs to be shared as a black woman, as a black filmmaker, and it's important that knowledge is shared through people and through Landray's book. And so, therefore, that's why I agreed and I contributed to the book.
Well, if you buy the book, you will read B's contribution. So, Dowdy, you're from Cambridgeshire, now in Nottingham, but Cambridgeshire, lonely place for you when you're growing up?
A little bit, yeah.
That's a leading question, by the way.
I think what, we were disconnected from a lot of black culture in East Anglia. I lived in a village called Ramsey. So I was really fortunate because I picked up guitar, and that in itself, opened up a new kind of community that wasn't, that was, you know, I found my way with it, and I made, my best friends were musicians, and that's kind of how I've moved through the world. And so, you know, but there was always a, you know, before people know you play guitar, before they know you sing, there was like a sort of litmus test of, you know, are you worthwhile? What's your value? So yeah, that was a bit isolating. Yeah.
Well, you're with friends tonight.
Yeah.
So, Daddy, will you play us a song? Daddy's going to play a song to begin with, and then we'll end the evening with a few songs from Daddy.
My song. I've been keeping all these secrets, each one with its own grip on me. Guess I'm scared of broken pieces, scared of all the mess you'll see. Secretly, I've not been breathing. Surprised you've not mentioned how I've been. My eyes, gray, they are unseeing. And my hands, cold and out of reach. Well, I am not some kind of demon. But it's what I see when I look in. Cause I told lies and then believed them. Promises like skin. Wasted time, but now I need it. I'm not the that you need. Cause I carry guilt from other seasons. So I don't expect you not to leave.
Thank you so much. Well done, Daddy. Thanks, Daddy. So, when you're a writer and you have a book published, you'll get a box of books from your publisher for free as a kind of bit of pocket money, alongside the huge amount of money you normally get for the book. And oftentimes you're meant to give the books away to your friends. So I wrote a book called I'm Black, So You Don't Have to Be. I've got a copy here. And when I tried to give the book away to my friends, they all said they'd bought a copy. I wasn't sure that they were telling the truth, really. But so what I'm going to do tonight, I realise I've got a cupboard full of books. So I'm going to give away a copy of this rather lovely book. I think it's lovely. I like it anyway. And but to get the book, you're going to have to answer a question. But don't answer the question if you don't want the book. Because there's nothing more embarrassing than giving away the book and then the guy comes back to you afterwards and says, do you know what? I don't think so. So the question is, I'm going to do a little dance for you now. And I'm going to ask you what kind of dance it is. Okay. But hold on, wait for the dance and then answer. Okay. There we go. Okay, any clues, any answers? What kind of dance was that? Apart from a dad dance, as someone say. No. It was a dad dance, but I would have done it from the seat if it had been a dad dance. Shout it out.
Over there.
Over there? No, it's a... Huh? Northern Soul is the answer. There's a reason for that little performance. Lanre, your book starts with a story about Northern Soul. Yes. Why did it start?
What segue. Absolutely needless. Absolutely needless. Amazing.
And why did you start that way and what did you learn?
So that you'd do that dance.
Thank you very much.
I had a vision. I saw an oracle and they said, do it. I want to start with Northern Soul because I think that's a cultural movement that quite a lot of people think they understand. And the basic story about that is, this is about white working class kids who were dancing to black working class music from America, and that's it. And I remember watching a documentary called Wigan Casino by a guy called Tony Palmer, which is like the documentary about Northern Soul. He took these film cameras in and went to an all-nighter in Wigan, and watching it and just spotting these black faces in the crowd, and just being like, what? Like, you are not supposed to be there. What is your story? And I was looking online and I couldn't really see that these people had been interviewed. So I thought, when I started doing the book, I thought, I want to speak to these people because I want to know what their stories are. Mm. And they were fascinating. Steve Caesar is the main person who I follow, a guy from Leeds, who won the first ever dance contest at Wigan Casino, which was a massive deal, won about 500 quid in today's money. And is this celebrated figure. If you go on the forums and stuff, people like talk about Caesar in these kind of glowing terms. And he was a guy who came over from St. Kitts as a 13-year-old and was plonked into Leeds and found his way through Northern Soul clubs and mod culture. And he was celebrated there, which wasn't the story I was necessarily expecting. There's a quote from Craig Charles in the book where he's talking about Northern Soul, and he said, you know, it was a racist scene. These kids weren't, you know, they'd suffered racism at the nights, which did happen. But guess what? That kind of happened everywhere in British society in 1975. You were going to get racist abuse, especially up north in certain places. So, I spoke to him. I spoke to a guy called Ian Obeng, who'd come up from Ghana and found himself in the Northern Soul scene and again was celebrated. Rhonda Finlayson, who is DJ Paulette's older sister, she won a dance contest and was really celebrated. So yeah, it was a way to get into this kind of underground scene and show that there was a black story, there was a racial story that we weren't being told. And actually when you zoomed out, it actually told you about, you could talk about the far right as well, because they were really active in these towns, navigating that and navigating politics in the mid to late 70s, when race became this kind of central thing, especially when Margaret Thatcher weaponized it. She gave her famous swamp speech in 1978. Interesting. I said the name Margaret Thatcher in Sheffield, and everyone just started booing. So obviously you lot are Tories, which is amazing. So, good for you. It must be nice to have money. Well done. It was actually in Sheffield. I'm joking. It was a joke. Come on. Yeah, when we were in Sheffield, it got to the point where there was one guy who he was booing every time I said Thatcher, but then he started booing every time I said London. I was like, this is not what I wanted to happen. This is going too far. So yeah, that was the reason I wanted to get
and
to know.
And have you been to a Northern Soul dance yourself?
I haven't actually.
Why not?
I haven't got a time machine. I can't go. But I mean, there are contemporary dances, and maybe I'll go along. Mm. It's not necessarily my type of music. Mm. So yeah, more of a drum and bass guy.
I'm going to ask you another question, but before that, who on this panel has danced Northern Soul apart from me? Malaika, Northern Soul person?
I didn't know about Wigan Pier.
Wigan Pier?
Yeah.
What was it like? Take us back.
I mean, I was only very young then, but again, as Langford points out, we was only a few of us black girls that went up there. Mm. And, you know, we enjoyed it. I mean, but I think we got more out of, you know, the soul clubs more, but we wanted to try something new when we went there, and it was fine. And we were a bit hesitant, as you point out, because of the National Front, and it was a white only clubs, and us as young black women going in there. But I think they allowed us in, but I don't think they'd be more worried about allowing young black men in.
Yeah. Larry, you make the point that it may not be as spectacular as the Rock Against Racism, but it actually introduced white people to black music and maybe acclimatised them to the idea that this was for them, and they might be more kindly predisposed towards black people as a result.
Yeah, and just I tried to kind of, because at that period, if you look back to like 78, 79, people talk about Rock Against Racism, which happened in Victoria Park, obviously, and went all around the country, actually. But that gig, because it was black groups like Steel Pulse alongside The Clash, it's seen as this cultural balm where people came together and pushed back against the National Front. I just wanted to make the point that there are other things that we should include in the anti-racist movement, and I think you can genuinely say Northern Soul was an element in that. You know, it's hard to say exactly what impact it had, but I think people who were going to those nightclubs, when you talk to them now, white people, I mean, who went along, a lot of them are anti-racist, you know, especially the kind of initial 70s into the 80s period. So yeah, I wanted to kind of poke at that, because I think sometimes people assume people up north are just like more inclined to be racist, which I don't necessarily think is the case. I always remember watching this documentary. It was Trevor Nelson in about 2008, I think. It was called Soul Nation. And at the start of it, he goes up to a Northern Soul club, and he could just tell he just doesn't want to be there. Like, he's getting his BMW, he's like, I've never been this far north. Like, if he just got up a nosebleed. And then he's hanging on with, like, Kev Darge, who's one of the DJs, and, like, you can just see him being like, it's like they're not going to bite your head off. They're just guys from Wigan who like to eat pies. Like, just chill. But, yeah.
Yeah, it's a strange thing to get used to, isn't it? I mean, I'm obviously from Luton, which is in the south, but not in London. And I remember when I first went to the north, and I was in Yorkshire, I went to a party. It was a dinner party, actually. And there was a guy there whose introduction to me was, all right, you black bastard. And, but it wasn't frowned upon or criticised by the host. It was just, that's just the way it was. And that's humour or something, or friendship. I'm not quite sure. But can we just come back a little bit before we get to Liverpool? Can we explain in a way that the book came about through Steve McQueen?
Right, yeah. Steve McQueen, the filmmaker, not the film star. Yeah, I interviewed him for when Small Axe was coming out. It was when Mangrove was about to premiere at the London Film Festival. And we had a conversation about that, and obviously that's five films that I build about being about black British life in a similar period to the one that I write about. But all the films are based in London. And that's because it's about Steve McQueen and these connections to his life, and he's obviously a Londoner. But at the end of the interview, I kind of just said, why didn't you base anything in, you know, you could have done one in Bradford, mate. And he very generously was like, you know, if we do a second series, we'd do that. And I went and wrote an op-ed piece for The Guardian after just saying, look, this is an issue here. We have a dearth of Black British stories that are told from outside of the capital.
Yeah.
I'm aware I'm in London right now, so I can hear you all just being like, what? That's where the book came from. Like, an agent got in touch and said, well, why don't you fill in the gaps? Why don't you fill in the blanks and kind of put across this other story? But yeah, I'm massively indebted to Steve. He gave me a great quote for the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. His stuff really inspired me.
Thank you. We're going to go to Liverpool shortly, but before we go to Liverpool, let's go via London and Brixton. And Malaika, will you read us a poem which is, in a way, cements Brixton as an important cultural phenomenon in this country?
Thank you. I will. It's a short poem. It's called, if you imagine, does anybody know the singer Kofi? Yes. If you imagine Black Pride playing underneath this poem, stop and search. If Brixton black, walking road black, is black, on train and black, young and black, boy and black, if black, 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 resistance, as bruised bodies bubble in blacked out blues dances, speaker boxes, bus dirty bass lines and sound men haul and pull up, till the streets erupt black, black is blah, 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 and blah. Thank you.
So we're going to travel back to Leeds shortly, Malaika, but before we go to Leeds, we're going to go to Liverpool.
Yes.
With B. And B, can you remember why you made the film They Haven't Done Nothing? Why did you make this film in 1985?
Yeah, well, we were commissioned by Channel 4 to originally make the film because of the ferocity of the uprising and, you know, the
uprising. Let's travel back. This is 1981, the
1981
uprising
in Liverpool.
Liverpool 8 or Toxteth?
No, Liverpool 8.
Okay.
Toxteth only came about because of the uprising.
Right.
Okay. But it's always been Liverpool 8.
So can you explain why you use the word uprising and not riot?
Yeah, because I think now people have said, oh, don't say riot, you know, say uprising.
What did you think it was a riot then?
Yeah, but it was a riot. It was a riot which came about, I've mentioned I'd give a dedication to Leroy Cooper.
Okay.
Because that was the start of it on July the 4th.
Okay. Well, why don't we show a little clip of the film that you made, They Haven't Done Nothing, and then we'll talk a little bit about what it shows. Can we have the clip, please?
When you sort of like allied the unrest with all the social conditions of unemployment and poor education and poor housing and so on, that's okay on the one hand, but at the end of the day, black people have always experienced that. And that's something which has never, ever been taken into account as far as those riots were concerned.
Well, the police come in officially to stop the rioting, but it's ended up from then that the police took over from where this crowd had finished. The police more or less took over from them because they'd done more damage and more arrests. Innocent people, which they did arrest innocent people.
So you were inspired to make that film because of what you saw and the forces that arrayed against people in Liverpool at the time.
Yeah, I mean, as a documentary filmmaker, I've always been documenting the black community from 1970s. It's something that I've done and I've built up a huge archive over the years. But when the riots came about and we got the commission from Channel 4, they wanted us to make a different type of film.
What kind of film did they want you to make?
Well, they were just expecting us to make something on black youth over pool tables. You know, the sort of image that they had at that time, you know. And we said, no, we turned the whole thing on its head. Mm. And we said, who benefits from riots?
Mm.
Who benefits? So in Liverpool, we went right back to 1919, when the riots took place in Charles Wharton Centre. A young black sailor from Bermuda He was resting in Liverpool until his next year. He was chased down to the docks by white groups and thrown in the dock and murdered. And nothing was said. Then there was the riots in 1948 again, and this time it was the dockers, the white dockers, against the ship, you know, black seamen. There was the riots then. Then there was the riots in 72, and then again in 81. So we had a history there of why these riots happened and who benefits. And that's why we start the film with the minister, Heseltine.
Michael Heseltine.
Yes, he was appointed minister for Liverpool, and one of the things he came up with Thatcher was to give us a garden city. He said, you know, if we give them a garden, they won't riot. This is what they need. And they gave us a, you know, all these people, yes, they need a garden city. And they started this garden city down by the docks. Not one person in the black community had a job out of it. The land there is still derelict after 40 years and being sold to a developer to build, because it's prime target now, because it's on the waterfront. And nobody ever got the job, and all the initiatives that was put in place by Heseltine and Project Full Employ, which I must say came from London, nothing. The only thing that came out of that was that we, the community and community activists, we got a law centre together. We got the access course as well together. So people were able to go on and do further studies, and, you know, Dr. Stephen Small, he's now in Berkeley, Dr. Andrew Christian, he's another one, he's in New York, and these are all the people who were done away with, or, you know, totally thrown away, said, oh, no good is ever going to become of them. So that's why I made the film, because I needed to say something, the history of the black communities.
Yes. Is that why you say the title, they haven't done...
And so nothing? That's why the title is... I know it sounds grammatically incorrect, but it's not. It's from Stevie Wonder's record. They haven't done nothing.
But at least, Lanry, you say that what the Tory government designed to do was manage to decline. So at least Heseltine was interrogating that notion of just letting Liverpool just go to rot.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, in Liverpool? I mean, maybe B can speak to this, but because Heseltine's this quite divisive figure where he's been given the freedom of the city by Labour councillors. And I interviewed him for the book. I went to his house. I say house. It's a massive country estate in Northamptonshire. He's massive as well. He should have played basketball. He's absolutely huge. He's a big bloke. Anyway, weird thing to mention, but I just thought I would. What we're talking about. He sees himself as being celebrated by the city of Liverpool. And then you talk to people from B's generation, and it's like, well, what did he do? Yeah. What did he actually achieve for this community? The reason he was there was because of what happened in LA. Yeah, as B says, you've got to look at all the initiatives. It was down by the waterfront, which was one of his obsessions. You know, he did it in London, down at the Docklands. They also did it in Cardiff. And it's interesting, like, you look at the black communities now around the country, and a lot of them, I went to one of the chapters about Cardiff and Bute Town and Tiger Bay. You go down there and the development is absolutely out of control. You know, so the black community is basically being hemmed in by the universities with student accommodation, really expensive flats that these communities can never afford. It's happening in Manchester as well. You know, these community assets are being bought up and turned into flats. So yeah, Heseltine probably quite happy with that because that's his vision. But what does that do to a black community? So yeah,
Thanks, Henry. So, Malaika, you went from this wonderful capital, Brixton, and you headed to Leeds. Why did you do such a thing? What were you thinking?
You know, this capital is all right, but actually, I love the beautiful Brixton. You know, let's be specific. There's London and there's Brixton. And Brixton is the oasis and the omega.
Have you been to Luton recently?
So I moved from Leeds. I moved from London, from Brixton to Leeds because I got a job. I got a fellowship at Leeds University for 2 years. So I moved there, but I moved to Chapel Town, which is amazing and beautiful in itself. And it's kind of like Brixton of Leeds. So it's very much full of an African community. Caribbean community, particularly most of the people there are from St. Kitts. And so right the corner shop, I can get my yam. This is what I'm really interested in. I can walk around and get my, you know, the hard o' bread and the yam and everything from the corner shop. I can walk into the, as soon as I see the Chapel Town sign, I'm seeing people who are saying good morning and good afternoon, and people still leave their doors open, and it's a very kind of beautiful space, and it's a very revolutionary space. It's a space that Lyndon Kwesi Johnson and Darkus and all these people would visit and go up there to kind of show union and in fellowship with some of the kind of activist things that were happening in that city. I'm a carnivalist.
And Leeds, I always thought, has the Leeds West Indian Carnival, right?
Well, I always thought London was, you know, because we're so big-headed, I thought that London was the start of carnival. I didn't know that Leeds West Indian Carnival was the first carnival to ever be created in the country. And also that the first person who took steel pan into schools came from, it was in Leeds, Mr. Morris, who revolutionized generations of steel pan players. So it's a really wonderful, revolutionary community place that I absolutely love. I miss Brixton, though, and I'm a Brixtonian to my soul.
Did you find you were welcome then? And the reason why I ask is because I did a bit of research as to where Caribbean people ended up when they came to this country. If you're from St. Vincent, you ended up in High Wycombe. If you're from Barbados, you ended up in Reading. Mm-hmm. If you're from St. Kitts and Nevis, you ended up in Leeds.
Yes.
But people from Guyana and Grenada didn't necessarily end up there. But were the Catticians welcoming for you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You say, oh, yeah, but I'm wondering whether you're being truthful here. Because
listen.
Tell you what,
Let me talk to you. Let me talk to you, right?
We'll talk afterwards.
The thing that... Grenada and St. Kitts have in common.
Yeah. They're small.
Let me start again and just ignore this person who obviously before Luton their family was from Jamaica because only Jamaicans say small. So let's move quickly on. No, the thing that we have in common is carnival and soca. And so in the parties, it's Catician soca. It's been so welcoming. It's been so beautiful. When my mother came over to visit me, she had a stroke. And the people from the Methodist Church put together and sent me cards saying they hadn't seen me at church and they heard what had happened. And people offered to drop me to the hospital because they knew I was going 3 times a day. So people put together and got together and said, okay, I'll drop you in this morning. And people would phone me and say, I'm outside your house to drop you in the evening. So it was completely beyond anything I thought about community. It's been fabulous, really.
Well, I was only joking, really, because my parents are Jamaican, but I think Jamaicans take up too much room. They make too much noise. They've got too high a regard for themselves. But actually, I think Caribbean found themselves in Britain, didn't they? Because when you're in the Caribbean, you don't necessarily island hop from St. Kitts to Jamaica. That's not going to happen.
No.
But people found each other because of the environment in which they found themselves.
Yeah, and there's Guyanese, there's Jamaican, there's Barbados, Bajans, there's all. It's just that St. Kitts is the majority, there are these little pockets of other Caribbean people. But there's a long history of everybody, you know. So they do. It feels like being in Grenada because someone would be like, "What's your?" You know, when people meet you, they'll be like, what's your surname? And I have to say, I'm not from St. Kitts. Because people will start, oh, yes, sir, so you are related, and so and so father. And so there's this really interesting thing of people tracing back and talking to you around where your position and who your family is. And that's, that's really...
Sometimes that explains the nicknames. So in Luton, the capital of Britain, when I was growing up in the 70s, all the Caribbean people, all the people of my parents' generation, they had these funny nicknames. So my father's Bag Eye, he had very baggy eyes. Shine was bald. Pumpkin Head had a pumpkin-shaped head. Tidy Boots was very fussy about his footwear. Anxious was always very anxious. Clock had one arm longer than the other. And my all-time favourite was a guy they called Summerware. And when Summerware came to this country from Jamaica in 1960, he insisted on wearing light summer suits, tropical suits, no matter the weather, come hail or storm. And when I was writing about him, I could remember his name, but I couldn't picture him. And I asked my mum, whatever became of Summerware? And she said, well, within a few months, he caught a chill and died. Because there's no way he can be called Summerware, you see him wear a heavy coat. But what I loved about that idea when I was growing up in Luton was that there was this kind of camaraderie, and there's a lot of teasing and liming and picong, but there's a sense of unity. Mm. But also, there's a sense of disunity as well, isn't there? Mm. There's lots of friction out there. Mm. Did you find that in Liverpool, that there wasn't necessarily one view, and that there was a lot of tussles between groups as to which way you should go?
Oh, yeah, very much so. In particular, when they, I think it was 1973, 74, when we had the first Caribbean Centre, and there was a lot of tussle over, you know, who should have the keys and who shouldn't.
The Jamaicans, probably.
So there was a lot of tussling over that, and then and who was on the board and who wasn't on the board, and, you know, and did you come first? And there was all of this that happened. And actually, what happened in the end, because these old men were all fighting over who should and who shouldn't, all the young black people went and they did a sit-in on the Caribbean Centre and said, the centre's ours while you're all fighting out there. They took the keys and they went in there, and there was a big sit-in. But that's another story, you know.
Lone, how did you find going around the country interviewing people? Were they readily able and willing to talk? Because there's a phrase you might, and there's a few black people in the audience, there's a phrase you'll hear, you go to any Caribbean or black house, when people start fishing for stories, they say, "Men, I like people to chat my business." Do people chat their business with you readily?
Yeah, thought about readily. I had to, obviously, like with the example would be, I had to kind of convince some people, quite a lot of people. But no, I think once people understood the concept of the book, people were open, people were into it. It was difficult sometimes because you're talking to people about incredibly emotional things that they might not have addressed for 40 years. A few people got very, very emotional.
Over what sort of things?
It could be about really innocuous seeming things. Like, I remember one of the chapters is about black people in the countryside, and one of the people I interviewed, we were talking about the film Kez, and this person just started crying, and he was like, "I've not thought about that film for so long, but as a kid, I felt like the kid from Kez, was kind of isolated, and all I've got is my bird watching, and this is what I'm into, and everybody thinks I'm crazy because I'm this black guy from Hull." And also, just to go back to the point you were making before about people clashing, the other thing, I mean, there's another version of this book where it's just beef between these different groups that I write about. Like, it seems fairly harmonious, but geez, man, some of the people, some of the interviews, like, I could not use them because they were just completely libelous. It'd be like 20-minute little dissection about, you know that guy that you're writing about? Yeah, well, he did this, and then he did that, and then he did... It's just like, okay, I can't use that. I'm gonna get sued. And I think, you know, that's an interesting point, because often these were young people at the time I'm writing about them in the book, and they had really strong views, and they wanted to change stuff, and they were facing these awful, at times, circumstances. So they wanted to make a change, and not everybody agreed with the right direction, and there was, you know, people were objecting to black feminists at the time, there was loads of that stuff. So it was a difficult time for people, but yeah, I convinced most people to talk. There were a few people who didn't talk to me. Somebody who will remain nameless wanted about $2,000 to do the interview, and I was like, nah, mate.
That was an interesting chapter. I reviewed your book. I thought it was a fantastic book. When you talk about the black arts movement from Wolverhampton, where interesting artists like Sonia Boyce are there, and there's a lot of men as well, and there's some friction between the men and the women, isn't there? What's that about?
Yeah, there was a key moment. So there was the Black Art Convention, National Black Art Convention, which happened in 1982 in the October. It was held in Wolverhampton because a lot of the black artists from the Midlands were based there. And the guest list was like Ingrid Pollard, Sonia Boyce, Claudette Johnson, John O'Confra, Frank Bolin went, like any big name that you can think of was there, basically.
Isaac Julian.
Yeah, actually, maybe not. Maybe not everybody. I don't think he was there. maybe he was. And there's these series of talks through the day. I think there was five. And Claudette Johnson was the last talk. And she gets up and she's talking about her work, which is all about portraiture and figurative painting. And she's talking about it in the context of Velázquez and these masters. And someone starts heckling her. Mm. She's the only person who's heckled throughout the day. And it causes this massive schism where the black women in the room get up because they want to continue talking about the work, but it's descended into this kind of back and forth. And they get up and they leave the room. Mm. And it's... Yeah, Sonia Boyce, Lebena Himid, all these people who meet for the first time in that moment and go off to have these amazing friendships and change British art forever. Mm-hmm. So, black men, sometimes they need to chill.
Sometimes the women carry the sound, don't they, Malaika? Do you want to give us a poem about the importance of women, mothers in black culture, black life?
Yes, I will. Actually, I think, you know, I had favourite poems in Pepper Seed, but I think this has become my favorite poem now. This poem is called Are Women at Funerals versus the Domino Installation?
Good title.
And it includes two quotes from two amazing, iconic Caribbean writers. One of the quotes is the women breathing like a black apostrophe to pain from Dennis Scott, the Jamaican poet. And the other quote is, held him the way Caribbean woman does rise his son with a drum beat upon him back. And that's from the Jean Binter Breeze. Are women at funerals versus the domino installation? It is always women, as if they're the holders of culture, the archivists, who can tell you what hymns to sing and what happens on each day. Who are industrious in the kitchen, cooking rice and peas, sawfish cakes, slicing bread, baking cake, seasoning chicken, and rocking babies. While our men mostly sit around the table like an installation. Fingers curled around ivory dominoes. Regularly, one would push back his chair, stand, step back to slap his last domino down with might, bouncing the table's load with his winning shot, then sit to shuffle the pack to deal again. With much old talk, throats arched back to knock back hard rum while claiming old time stories about the dead. How as they sit, my aunties like invisible worker bees replenish empty bottles, exchange dirty glasses, and refill saucers with sweet biscuits. Heap food would magically appear in front of each man. Even in Deadhouse, making him feel like a king in a country that only wants to see a beast in him. These women are a black apostrophe to pain. See how they contain, hold on, pass on, hold in, know what is expected, how to bathe the body, dress the dead like they're alive so they leave this world with dignity. How they contain, feeding and feeding those bodies in grief. They are our institutions. The way they curve and curve their bodies like small brackets. She tells me how she curved her back to help her boy when grief dragged him down in her front room. His first funeral service and how it hit him snot and eye water hard. Held him the way Caribbean woman does rise his son with a drum beat upon him back. Held him as he bawled, rocked this big man she brought into the world like the baby she cradled at birth, and she contained, she shushed, rubbed his back, patted, contained. These women are our breath, our oxygen, vital for our survival. Those proud, upright spines, how they crack and straighten under all this lead, dead weight. Thank you.
Thanks, Malaka. As we were reading that, I was thinking of my brother's funeral, actually. And when we all went back to the house, people didn't know what to do. And slowly but surely, the Caribbean women just started to sing and held people's hands and held them and held the moment. And it was a really transformative moment. You realise then that women are the source, for me anyway. Oh, yes. They've always been the source, so thank you for that. You're also the source of a wonderful collection called Malaika's Kitchen. We have Roger Robinson in the house.
Really? Hey, Roger!
Tell us about how Malaika's Kitchen, which is a collection of poets, came about and what they did, and how you transferred that idea, if you did, to Leeds.
Okay. You don't ask easy questions. So we had been hungry for to learn and develop as writers, and we were excluded from all the spaces, all the white spaces. And so Bernadine Evaristo and Ruth Brothwick started this organization called Spread the Word. And Kwame Dawes had won the Forward Prize, and so he came and did some workshops with us. And every time he came, he did Afro-style school with us. And some of the most, Patience Akbarbi, some poets, all of us were there. We were really hungry. And I remember I was sitting in the kitchen with Roger Robinson, in my kitchen in Brixton, and I was saying to him, oh my gosh, you know, we need this. We need other writers that experience this. You know, going up to a writer and telling them when they come off the stage, this was, you know, you need to look at this work and stuff. It's not the space. And he said, we can do it. And I said, okay. And he said, I said, when should we start? And he was like, next week. And I was like, okay, so where should we do it? He's like, right here in the kitchen, in this house. And so Malaika's Kitchen was born. The first kitchen, there was only one poet. And he sat between me and Roger. And it was an intense session. and then gradually it grew. We would just see people and invite them. And people came. I thought it was going to be once a month. Imagine my surprise when, you know, we finished one of the Fridays and everyone said, see you next week. Which means every Thursday I had to clean my house. My mom reckons that that's why I'm single, because it was prime date night time. And instead of dating, I was with a whole bunch of poets doing some literature thing. But it was a space where we met up, we critiqued each other's work, we read new work. We brought our skills back with each other. And we just wanted this space to grow, to nurture each other, to become a community where if someone's doing a gig, we would support them, where we would support people in teaching workshops. And we just kind of developed with our own system for development. And little did we know that all these people who came would go on to be such big names in literature later on.
How do you keep it real? Because I can imagine if you start something like that in your kitchen, a little kitchen industry, cottage industry, then the beauty of it is its smallness. When it starts to grow, how do you maintain the same energy and enthusiasm and sincerity that you had at the beginning?
I think the one thing that we were adamant about is about the work. And it's about being in service to the work and being in service to yourself as an artist and your development. And the work for sitting around a table as a writer critiquing is kind of like the rules for the kitchen, being respectful to each other, you know, being able to be kind of honest, but with integrity and just with a soft tenderness, right? You know, you're saying to someone, this beautiful thing that you see, it's not working, the first verse is not working, you have to get rid of it. Or, you know, or reading poems together listening. So it's listening, respect, it's honesty, it's really trying to enable all of us to be the best that we can be at our craft. That's how it worked, really.
How does it work in terms of criticism when you're in Yorkshire? Because Yorkshire people tend to be a little bit blunt, don't they?
I haven't, because for the last 5 years I've been doing a PhD, Malaika's Kitchen has been on a kind of hiatus, so I haven't been doing the kitchen. But I have been to workshops, people tree run workshops with young writers there. And I think you find the same thing. Writers, when they're starting out, they're all insecure, you know. and really trying to do this thing that sometimes your family don't understand, you know? You know how much people come in and say, like, you know, my mom and dad, they're looking for me to be a lawyer and a doctor, and I'm telling them that I'm going to do creative writing at university. So so actually, sometimes it's the only space where you can, where you're recognized and where you're meeting people who are like-minded.
Mm. Bea, did you meet like-minded filmmakers when you were making these documentaries?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I have to say, we started the first Black Media Association with, at the time, the late Dorcas Howe, Stuart Hall, Terry Galley. And the reason why that was started, because we were trying to get ourselves into the film industry, but you couldn't get a job unless you had a union ticket, and you couldn't get a union ticket unless you had a job. And so therefore, us as Black filmmakers, we all wanted to tell our story, but we were telling it to each other and not to the wider audience who we wanted to tell that story to. So that's why the Black Media Workers Association was formed. And we actually changed the course of history here in the UK, because we got the union we got the union to change, and then we were all issued with cards. But it was like through protest, of course, you know, spearheaded up with Dorcas at the time and Bernie and everybody.
And then that
paved the way then for other young filmmakers. And I mean, we were there, we started, you know, doing our craft, being creative and again and all. But we were all around each other. I mean, because if I got a job to make a documentary, I was able to call on other people to come and support me to make that documentary. So I didn't have people say, oh, look, she's made that documentary and look at it. We were all supporting each other. And then, you know, and if somebody else got a contract, it's ring me up and say, B, can you come down and do this? And, you know, I was down there in an instant because it was important.
That's really heartening. One of the threads, Lanry, maybe we'd all attend to this question, and we're going to pass the baton to Daddy soon, but this idea about nothing came before, about the history that you don't know about, you were discovering things you didn't know about when you were writing your book.
Yeah.
That sense that this is a kind of Black presence or a Black cultural presence, have we not known about it just by negligence, just by oversight, or is it something more sinister? Is it designed that we don't know what came before? Maybe we could all attend to that question. You go first.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a massive tendency in this country for, especially like established historians, just to dismiss Black British history. Like, it's just not part of the story. It doesn't get woven into that wider narrative. I was listening to a very popular history podcast, The Rest is History, and they did a special on 1981. And I was like, oh, I'm really interested to see what these guys do on what happened. And they talked about Brixton, and they talked about it for about 3 minutes, and it was because Tom Holland is from there. I grew up there, amazingly. So he just talked about what it was like, and then they moved on, and it was like, hang on a minute, you talk about 1981 and you've spent 3 minutes on this. Like, this was seismic, it was massive. I mean, you saw the pictures from Liverpool. Like, it completely shook the Thatcher government. They did not know what to do. They had to respond to this moment, and so did the rest of the country. So yeah, it's those choices that are made editorial, I think, to dismiss stuff. And I think I was watching Adam Curtis's latest documentary, Shifty, and there's this bit about liberals in that, and I think there is a liberal problem in this country where people just don't believe that race is something that they need to deal with. That's an American thing. Or maybe it happens in Africa, but it don't happen here. And if it does, we're this welcoming community where, as B spelled out with her film, you know, you look at 1919, 1948, 1972, 1981, look at Ballymena the other week. Yeah. That's part of that continuum. Mm-hmm. You know, this is part of our country. It's what happens because we don't address this history. And it's always a surprise when it kicks off. Like, it shouldn't be, because we're not addressing the issues. So, yeah, I think you can say there's something sinister going on, I think. I think that's fair to say. And I think there's a kind of negligence at the heart of it. But it's okay, read my book and we'll figure it all out. There we go. Buy 15 copies each and it'll be great.
So very briefly, Bea and Malaika, do you want to address that point about how you find things that have gone before if they appear to have been hidden or forgotten?
And I think as someone who is sometimes in commissions constantly surprise me, I remember a lot of us Caribbean poets being commissioned to look at the Scottish involvement with the slave trade. And we couldn't find anything we were, you know, and I remember talking to Kai Miller, thinking, look at the Jamaican flag, it's like hidden in, look at the telephone directory and the names, and it's like, and the names of streets and stuff, and it's like hidden in plain sight. And there was this prominent project to kind of address that. And as a result of that, you started to get a lot of history books that started to explore that. And it's the same way when we did research on black soldiers serving in the world wars. And I think that we live in a country where the erasure of black history is easy, and the erasure can happen just within one day, you know? So when you see poppies and the people wearing them and the testimony being given over and over again, and you speak to Jackie Kay, who was doing her research in Scotland, and she speaks about this gentleman who's 100 and something in an elderly home, who cries on that day because he watches that and doesn't see himself represented. Mm-hmm. And the nursing home, they have that information. Even then, they're kind of like, I didn't even know that you guys served in there. So there's a kind of systematic kind of erasure that happens. And what's really exciting is the resilience. I don't know, it feels like people come to an age of like 16, 17, 18, and they just relentlessly become researchers trying to find identity and find themselves, and they dig that history up, and that's happened generation from generation.
Thank you. And finally, B, this point about how you inform people who don't know what's gone before. I mean, what you're doing, your archiving. I didn't know you from before this day.
Yeah, I've been documenting, as I said, it's not just me, we've got the Liverpool Black History Research Group now.
Yeah.
They dig deep down into everything. I mean, because Liverpool has had a black community since 1700.
Mm.
Last year we laid the stone for an unknown, well, for Charles Wotton, who was murdered. He was in an unmarked grave. And then we also laid another stone for Pastor Daniel E. Carter, and he set up the first children's home in Liverpool when the white British government didn't want the black, what they call brown babies then, and the Americans didn't want them. And so Pastor Daniels, he set up the first orphanage in Liverpool. And it's these type of histories.
Mm.
And we've now, you know, expanded that out. And through the history research group, there's people now digging into that. And there's a whole new story now to tell about the African mission.
Yeah.
And the first, the first orphanage.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bea. I'm so delighted to have met you, because you're going to become part of the Writers of Mosaic family. And you can hear more about Bea's films and Bea's approach to creativity in the near future on our site. But for now, I'd like everyone to thank Bea Freeman, Landry Bakery, and Malaika Booker. Thank you very much. So we're going to relax. Our work is done, and we're going to listen. We're going to delightfully listen, and we're going to stay on stage to keep him company as Dowdy plays out tonight. Thank you, Dowdy.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to play you a new tune called Dead Bird.
Dowdy's got this killer smile, isn't he?
And it's, I'll try and be brief, it's the difficulties of untying internal knots of hatred, of self or other. So I'll just
take it out.
I cannot change things. to. I cannot get back the time. Can't tell the difference. Weight on my shoulders. Anger built up over time. How to tell you without causing tears in my eyes. I fucking is eating me alive.